ferrite, if there is a ferrite, it looks like a ferrite, core is grounded.
I see that, and that's part of where the input to output isolation is coming from, although the grounding of the core is going to give you a stray capacitance to ground on the secondary leads of that transformer. And I occasionally at some RF frequencies I could give you a little bit of a grief. Since this thing is only going up to 10 megacycles, I don't think that's much of a problem. So you and John have discussed this a whole lot, and I guess my first question, John, is where do you believe is the best place to apply this? KC2WGB, K2RIW and SICNAT.
KC2WGB. Dick, as you know, it's a passive device, and it can be used either direction if you look at it. And output end goes to a balanced, what looks like a PL259 with two pins on it. That plugs into a little module. That little module has two phone plugs on it, like an operator's phone set. And that went into the receiver. That plugged in. Now you could use it going backwards to a piece of test equipment, or you could inject the signal into it. And that one, I've never seen that particular one, but I've seen similar ones made by Northeast Electronics, which also made a lot of stuff for the Bell Labs. And George, IKT, thinks it was used in examining multiplex audio and signals on telephone lines. And that's basically, and he knows the company. It was very prevalent in the telephone industry. So we're pretty sure of what that is. The exact use for it, I have no idea.
Something like a think.
Beacon double, IKT is on.
For the military, and with the all of the military requirement for it. If that was... at first, what was the year for it? I believe it's 77. I was trying to look at all of these printings on it. And then we're talking about already a multi-frequency telephony and the portable device to measure it. For the I'm just curious, what the heck was that?
Dick, IKT is on. George?
If I'm not mistaken, Electric was bought by GTE sometime around the period that that device was made. Typically, it's a common carrier device. Pretty sure it's to allow a piece of test equipment to go and monitor a balanced line. Test equipment would typically have a 75-ohm coax input. Balanced line is your 125-ohm, 124-ohm Twinax that you see on the device. Obviously, the military bought this particular unit that Wesley has. And I think Wesley is fixated on the fact that it has a high-voltage BNC connector on the unbalanced side. Now, that high-voltage BNC connector has the advantage of having relatively low capacitance, which is why I think they chose it. But it is not, let me repeat, not a high-voltage device. Dick?
Now, what is the typical impedance, George, of a telephone circuit? I'm having trouble believing it's 124 ohms. Go ahead.
Yeah, the telephone company would surprise you with the type of impedances that they have. Video circuits would very commonly, in the 60s and 70s, use 124-ohm Twinax. They also, if it was on the copper wire, a twisted pair copper wire was, 600 ohm impedance would be what we would call it. But in reality, they sent their equipment up to 900 ohms. Strangely enough, because that's what the actual impedance of the so-called 100-ohm line is at the telephone company's reference frequencies, which are around 400 hertz. As you probably know, on a twisted pair line, the impedance decreases as you go up in frequency. So your 600-ohm line is 600 ohms at 10 kilohertz or so. But then as your frequency goes up, it becomes asymptotic, and it becomes about 100 ohms. At the frequencies that we're using these lines on today, namely, using them with Ethernet LAN on Cat 5 and Cat 6 type cable. But, this Twinax was commonly used for video. I recall seeing arrays of patch cords, patch fields with exactly those types of patches on them in video centers. And the point was to make the line, the transmission system, flat to about 10 megahertz so they could transmit video. And I have no doubt that it was easy to sell that concept to the military and put it on an airplane. Nick, thank you.
Now, when it comes to twin lead, when you look up the reference data for radio engineers and you want to know the impedance of twin lead, it's a function of the spacing between the two wires, the diameter of the two wires, and the dielectric material that's between them. And in order for the impedance to start off at 900 ohms at low frequencies and asymptotically approach 100 ohms at high frequencies, I'm having a little bit of a problem. You're not changing the spacing of the wire. You're not changing the diameter of the wire. The rubber insulation could be a very dispersive material. And is that where the change of impedance versus frequency is taking place? Simultaneously, I'd also like to know a DSL phone circuit. What kind of impedance is it running? And by the way, CAD6, CAD5 and CAD6 cables, I have used them at RF frequencies at 1,000 megacycles. They are 100 ohm cables. The CAD6 is a lot more controlled, a lot lower in loss at 1,000 megs, but very close to 100 ohm twisted impedance of each of the four twisted pair in there. Over to you, George, K2RIW.
K2RIW, WDTIK. I'll go back to my, in a Belden application note, and I can, if I dig it up, I can come up with the precise formula that they use. But basically, there's a transition mode going on in which it which the signal traveling down the cable transitions from one mode of operation to another as a function of frequency, in addition to the dielectric constant. And I'll have to go and look up that formula with three components to it. So there's basically a low-frequency component, the transition region component, and then there's the asymptotic component. The asymptotic one is 100 ohms.
Question, why did they put a flip switch for the low and high frequencies on this device?
Comment, Dick.
Yeah. I'm having trouble believing that there's more than one mode there, George. If you're using twin lead in the thoroughly differential balanced mode, what other mode is there between twin lead? It's a transverse electromagnetic mode, twin lead, very similar to the way 300 ohm twin lead used to work or 200 ohm ITT twin lead, because these wires are much closer together. And by the way, the tightness of the twist is an extremely minor phenomena. In the case of a CAT5 or a CAT6 cable, you have four different twist rates in order to get isolation. But I think the majority of the differential mode between the two twin leads of one pair, I'm having trouble believing there's more than one mode as a function of frequency. At least it appeared to be pure differential mode that I was using all the way up to 1,000 megs. Now back to you, George, and then pass it over to John.
Okay. First of all, I don't think we're using the word mode in the same manner. You're using mode the way that one would when looking at solving Maxwell's equation, and I don't think I was. So let's get that main piece out of the question. Part two, I'm actually trying to look up the formula so I have it in front of my face, not just talking to it. I want to actually have it so I can look at it. And I'll get there. Dick, why don't you pick it up while I go on the first thing?
Very fine, George. Take your time. John, you wanted to say something? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick. If I remember correctly, this instrument was manufactured about the same time they were doing video phones, picture phones, whatever you want to call it. And that device was plugged in at the CO in a different form. This is a military form. I believe this one was used on aircraft. So that they could go from the video information by changing those two switches to their instrumentation, which was 75 ohms. They could look at the video carrier traveling, or they could go to the audio channel. And I believe that's exactly where that piece was used. The only reason I'm saying that is I've seen one similar. It was made by Northeast Electronics, and it was used on aircraft for video and audio telephone systems throughout the large body aircraft, very large bodies.
Okay, now, the upper of those two switches allows you to select a low-pass filter that goes from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. And that certainly sounds like everything you care about when it comes to audio. 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz on a very young set of ears. That's where the human ear responds, and beyond that it essentially stops on both ends. But for the video filter, it says 20 kilohertz to 10 megahertz. The frame rate of video, of normal NTSC video, for instance...
No, it was slow scan.
Even worse. I was about to say the 20 kilohertz is not low enough to pass the 60-cycle sync pulses or the 15 kilohertz horizontal sync pulses. And if I go to slow scan, I'm going into even lower frequencies yet. So the 20 kilohertz to 10 megahertz doesn't go low enough to transmit the kind of video I'm used to seeing in the old days. Back to you, John.
Okay, I don't know if it operated on 60 hertz. I don't know what the frame rate or that rep rate was. But you may be right, but that's the only thing I've seen that's even close to that device.
V-type AT-PAC, found the formula.
You got it, George. Go ahead.
Okay, this is from a Belden application. Of the low-frequency area, called the low-frequency region, which goes up to about 20 kilohertz, the low-frequency curve for the pizza cable is D sub 0 equals the square root of this quantity, R divided by J2 omega FC is the capacitance between the cables. R is the series resistance of the conductor in ohms per unit length.
Do you believe a thoroughly differential signal is being sent down a pair of wires in that low frequency mode? Go ahead, George.
Yes, I do, because that's how they eliminate noise and crosstalk, by balancing the cable extremely carefully. One thing telcos always did was make sure that the devices, they made extremely high quality audio transformers for this, had actually their audio video transformers, they had flat response from a few hertz to tens of megahertz. I believe that's what's sitting in that very device that Wesley had bought. Anyway, the low frequency curve had that equation I just said. The transition region, where it's going from low to high frequency, goes from about 20 kilohertz or so to 100 over a megahertz, I guess. That's D sub 0, D sub the cable. The transition region is equal to the square root of numerator is R plus J2 by FL divided by G, where G is the shunt conductance in Mohs per unit length, G plus J2 pi F sub C. Okay, that's the transition radio. Now, at the asymptotic region, that bellies out, and it becomes the formula that we all know for this stuff, which is Z sub 0 equals the square root of L divided by C. And I think that's a formula you're familiar with. Z sub 0, which is the nominal impedance, is 176 log D over R, where D is the spacing between the centers of the two conductors, R is the radius of each conductor, and there's also room in here for the square root of the relative permittivity of the dielectric. So put that all together, and that's how the cable impedance works.
Well, the thing that I don't understand is, at first, if they were to use this device for both voice and a video, then they could have operation only one time, which for me stands for the fact that it couldn't be both. And the second thing is, if you could take a look at the curvature of the frequency flatness, that curvature is pretty nice flat, but it does not correlate with the switching of the switches. It looks just like it shows whatever the range of the frequency from the beginning curve to the total flatness. My question was, how come they could deliver so nice a switching of the impedance of the input, or whatever the input it is, or the output, so it doesn't change with the changing of the position of the switches and switches?
It looks like the curve that's traced is the high frequency, the 20 kilohertz to 10 megs. And there may not be a curve for the 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. You just know ahead of time that it's going to be a similar looking curve. That's a good guess on my part. But, George, I got a question for you. Coaxial cable is normally 176, one over square root of the dielectric constant, 176 log of A over B, the diameters. You and I know that coaxial cable, if I picked up a piece of 50 ohm coax cable and I measured it from DC to light, so to speak, the 50 ohm cable would be within 1 or 2 ohms of 50 ohms down at 60 hertz. It would be within 1 or 2 ohms at 1 gigahertz. The coaxial cable does not change impedance as a function of frequency. And that's the 176 formula, 138, correction, it's the 138 formula and a log of A over B. In the case of twin lead, there's a 276 formula and a log of a diameter and spacing. Why should the twin lead used in a differential manner with a rather similar formula, why should twin lead change impedance versus frequency when coax doesn't do that? And the theory of operation of a coax transmission line and the theory of operation of a twin lead transmission line, in my mind, are not that different. I'm having a problem. I'll back you, George, K2LIW.
Okay, that's really a great question. Probably pressing on the limits of what I would actually do. Again, this formula and this graph I'm looking at are from Belden. They're in the Belden cable network. Looks to me like the permittivity of the dielectric is changing. So in frequency, up in frequency from the very low frequencies up to VHF and VHF range that the K works on, because the chart starts at 10 hertz and it goes up to a gigahertz. And I'm assuming the resistance is relatively constant. The skin effect would be changing. I'm not sure that would have a huge effect on it. The biggest variable I see here is the relative permittivity of the dielectric changing.
I have at the salt mine that great big fat Belden book, 8.5 by 11, probably 1.5 inch and 3/4 thick, which they have zillions of various kinds of cable in the Belden catalog. I presume there's a information section, an engineering section at the back or in the front or somewhere in the damn book. And if I want to look up the cable that changes impedance with those three formulas, tell me what cable model number of Belden I should look up is question number one. And I guess question number two is going to be, I know that when I was using CAD 6 cable at 1 gig, it had a very nice kind of dielectric that was holding the twin leads. It was a some kind of a holding form, if you know what I mean. It kept your four twisted pair in a very specific geometry with reference to each other. I'm having trouble believing that CAD 6 would change an impedance with those three formulas. Maybe CAD 5 does, but I'm having trouble believing that CAD 6 would do that. So which cable model number should I be looking up in that fat Belden catalog? Over to you, George, K2LIW.
That formula, Dick, is given for the entire line of Belden local area network cables. CAT5, CAT5E, and CAT6. Oh. And I don't have the book in front of me, but I'm looking at an excerpt from it. So let me see if I someplace have the book online, and I'll see if I can find the exact model number. K2RIW and the group WB2IKK.
A question that I have is, maybe for three of you gentlemen, was the device used primarily as a permanently mounted device for the aircraft communication, voice and video, or was that a piece of measurement device? Because it looks like an extremely nice gun, but it's portable. And if it was used in the fixed application, it should not look like that. Enter a shift.
I think we've got to be careful with the word video. To a person who is transmitting low-speed or high-speed data from point A to point B, The higher speed data, many an engineer will call it video, high speed video. And this 20 kilohertz to 10 megahertz could be the frequency range of a particular mode of operation of digital data. Maybe analog, I'm going to guess it's digital data. And we are guessing that that is video. I don't think that is conventional, old-fashioned, 625 scan line type television video. So the word video is a relative word from my point of view. High-speed data, many an engineer will call it video, even though he's not using it to draw technicolor pictures, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, but 1977, Dick, what kind of speed did they have at that time?
I think they were just starting to experiment with 56 kilobits over telephone lines, and they were doing it with, I believe it was 16 QAM. So your bit rate and your frequency response has to have some guard band to it. In other words, if I'm going to 56 kilobits, I'd have to go to at least 5 megacycles to produce the square waves, the square edges of 56 kilobit data accurately. That's a guess on my part. Let's see what George can say about that. KQRIW.
Okay, Dick. Just a quick note. On the video, the Harriers, no, they didn't really originate the video. All they did was transmit it. And the prime thing that they were carrying across the country was actually broadcast video. Standard NTSC baseband, not RF modulated video, would then go down these twin axes. And they had special repeater stations and the one for them. The matching networks that you see on that balun, on that 760 test set, I'm guessing, this is my opinion, is that they are used to tune out the reactants in those balun transformers to smooth out the peak that such things would have and to flatten out the frequency response. That's why I think they're there. I don't think they're there for any other purpose. Dick, back to you.
Okay, if the baseband video, not RF modulated, of an NTSC television signal, which has sync pulses that go down to 60 hertz with square wave, but the 60 hertz sync pulses, I couldn't get them through this lower of the two filters that starts off at 20 kilohertz and goes to 10 megs. Maybe the 20 kilohertz to 10 megs is a miswriting. Maybe it's supposed to be 20 hertz to 10 megs. Is that possible, George? Go ahead.
It's possible. I also think that these devices went through what I call a sync pulse clamping amplifier, which would sort of ease the low frequency requirements on that device somewhat. If you clamp the amplitude of the sync pulses, as long as it can recognize that where the sync pulse is, I believe that, you know, the active electronics in the, along the cableway, remember that still is a lot of loss, and every few miles you'd have a essentially a video repeater. And in the late 50s and 60s, when these things were designed, that was a hell of an achievement.
Yeah, but Rich, don't you think that if it was for the military with the military specification and the style, the room for the error was there? I believe you've seen the video that I have made, Rich.
No, I haven't seen your video yet. If I try to transmit 60 frames for 30 frames per second, 60 fields per second, NTSC video, through a filter that has the low end at 20 kilohertz, I will see spikes of the leading edge and the trailing edge of the 60 hertz sync pulses, and maybe that's enough to reconstruct. But I lived through the era, George, where in roughly 1949, Howdy Doody and Buffalo Bob on Channel 4 NBC television made a big deal about the fact that the coaxial cable was being strung across the United States. And as such, in a short period of time, video from California or some other place in the United States was going to get to New York City by way of the coaxial cable. Why did they go over the coaxial cable if this twin lead system was doing it so nicely with its repeater stations? Over to you, George. You may not be born early enough to remember that era. KQRIW.
Something tells me, Dick, that they were calling it coax and it was really this TwinAx. Because, you know, every time I've been in an interconnect center, and, you know, that was a long time ago, I got to admit, 40 years, you know, or so. I was pretty awed by the place, but you know, I saw 124-ohm TwinAx PAX panels all over the place, and it was baseband video I was looking at them on. Yours truly assumed that that's the stuff that actually went underground or aerial and went for miles and miles to the next city. I could be mistaken, but I'm speculating that that's what they did.
Okay, it sounds like you've got a lot of experience with Ma Bell. And the trunking system where you had groups, master groups, super groups, and whatever, you had a whole bunch of signals with suppressed carrier, single sideband, very specific spacings of carriers and pilot tones and whatever, all running around 2.5 gigahertz on these microwave links, 30-mile spacings between towers. That eventually was carrying an awful lot of audio as far as individual telephone circuits are concerned. I guess I assume that that could also be carrying video. What was that? Those microwave links at roughly 2.5 gigahertz, was that a parallel system to this 124-ohm twisted, shielded thing that was carrying a video that maybe is what the Howdy Doody and Buffalo Bob were calling the coaxial cable? Were these two systems running in parallel, George? K2RIW?
No, I wish I knew, Dick. I'm sorry. I really don't know. I just assumed that the TwinAx probably had somewhat less loss than the coax, and because it was balanced, it was more noise immune than the coax and probably less fussy in terms of grounding and terminating. So I could easily see why they'd be compelled to use a TwinAx instead of a coax. And probably they just called it coax as to, I hate to say not confuse people, but 40 years later they may be confusing us, but something tells me that's what they called coax.
The GTE Lenkert company in California, San Carlos, California, had a whole bunch of these monthly journals that they put out, little tiny books that were about 3 inches wide and about 6 inches high, a crazy format, where they told you about their telephone systems and microwave linking systems and tropospheric propagation and weather conditions and all this kind of jazz. GTE Lenkert has a beautiful engineering book that I've got a copy of with a bunch of charts inside for 2-gig links, 6-gig links, and 12-gig links. They tell you everything you want to know about what a Mother Nature can do, what your Fresnel zones are like, the clearances between microwave links, between mountaintops, and you got valleys in between and trees in between and other things that are interfering with the Fresnel zones. These watermelon-shaped graphs of where objects that intrude on that signal are hitting either the odd phase or the even phase on the reflection off of those trees and other things between these microwave links. An awful lot of that engineering hardcore data was done by the GTE Lenkert company. Is that different than this company that calls itself Lenkert? Did one buy the other? Is one an earlier name of the other? The GTE Lenkert catalogs and engineering manuals.
Lenkert was acquired by GTE.
Okay, but these GTE Lenkert engineering books, I was purchasing those in the late 60s, early 70s. Let's see now. Early 70s. So when did that transition occur, if you happen to know, George? K2RIW?
Let's see. Lenkert was the supplier to Salvania, which, of course, had an awful lot of the rural telephone companies. And I started becoming aware of the industry when I was in high school. So I figured that was the late 60s. So stuff happened before that. I'm afraid I was just a little kid. Stuff afterwards was through that journal. And I got the same journal you did, I think, way back when, with their solutions and their products and their really well-written app notes. It taught me a lot. So I would suspect it happened sometime during the 70s.
So I think you're saying, Wes, that the GE bought Lenkert somewhere around, we'll make a guess, 1970 or so, over the U.S.?
Well, the GTE was formerly the General Telephone and Electronics Corporation. That was somewhere in between 59 and 82. And they were the kind of independent telephone company in the United States during the days of the Bell system. They were originally founded in somewhere 20s, 29, I believe, very early, by the Associated Telephone Utilities Company that was bankrupt in 1933. I'm trying to recall when was... I know that they've been with the Sylvania Lighting. That was somewhere in 30s, 34. They owned Automatic Electric Company. They were equipment supplier, very much similar to the Western Electric. And since Sylvania was also in... Sylvania was non-communication-oriented company under the GTE owners. Oh, okay, fine. So the Sylvania was a part of GTE, but they were non-communication company. But GTE provided the telephone service. Boy, I'm thinking, when was that?
This Lenkert 760A 760A test transformer. I am guessing you bought this from eBay. Since you bought serial number 256, out of curiosity, the person who sold it to you, did he have more than one to sell? Wes, go ahead.
That was the only one that I found listed. The curiosity was because of the fact that it was high voltage transformer, thanks to which, I mean, high voltage the connector. But thanks to which, I find out that it was because of the low the lower capacity factor. Right? Do I say it properly?
And maybe you address that to George. This is a UHF-like connector with a dual center conductor. Is that what the output connector on this, the 124-ohm connector? Over to you, George.
That's in the picture. I don't have this thing. Wesley has it, so I'm assuming that it's a standard twin-axial connector, which, yeah, it looks like a TL-259, except that it has a insert in it that has two pins in it, side by side. And it goes to a twisted pair that's inside a shield, I guess, as you know, called a twin axial cable.
Well, John knows exactly. I wonder if Rich, did you have a chance to see the video?
No, I haven't seen the video yet. So the video will show you testing this thing, or you will walk around it and show
everything inside and outside. I created two videos. The second one that I sent the link to is the 10-minute version. Shows everything with the details.
George, that the TwinX connector, which is a little bit like a PL-259, but it's got two center pins. The two center pins are arranged in such a way that when you engage them between male and female, there's only one particular polarity that they'll go together. You can't mix up the left and the right, so to speak. Is that true, George?
Actually, I don't know. And that characteristic would be if they were somewhat off-center, or if one was larger or smaller than the other, or if there was a keyway in the conductor. And I'm not sure. I didn't see a keyway in the picture. I did look at the video, and I really can't tell if they're off-center from the videos, at least enough so that you would prevent from being plugged in with a reverse clamp.
I'm going to interrupt you guys. I found something. In 1950s, including Peninsular Telephone Company in Florida with 300,000 lines, and Lenkert Electric Company Incorporated, a leading producer of microwave and data transmission systems. There was the merger. For General Telephone, the merger meant to add benefit of Sylvania extensive research and development capabilities in field electronics. Okay, we're talking 1959.
Interesting. George, I have seen a kind of twin-axe shielded twin-lead connector where if you lay the connector on the table and you're looking, excuse me, you're looking into the connector and the two pins are each equally spaced from the table. In other words, they're horizontally left and right of each other. And if you look into the male or the female, I'm not sure which, the plastic above and below the two leads, there's a step to it. In other words, the plastic above would be closer to you, the plastic below would be further from you, and the opposite polarity exists between male and female. Therefore, they only go together with one particular polarity. So if the red wire is always on the left-hand side of the connector, it forces that particular polarity. You can end up with a twist. And I think there are some times in video where that could be very important. A buddy of mine was once collecting video from space from from the Apollo 15 spacecraft, and he had a miswiring in the electronics that he constructed, and the video ended up inverted in polarity. And so that gave him a negative picture on the screen and sync pulses that the set wouldn't lock up to. And with all kinds of expedience, he had to, in that brief period when the space downlink was taking place, he had to find a way in his system of reversing the polarity. So my guess is the polarity of the twin lead could be critical in some applications. Does that seem to make sense, George, K2LAW?
Oh, it sure does. Lots of systems, I would think it's critical. However, since I don't have the things in front of me, I can't tell you definitively whether or not there's some method of mechanically preventing somebody from twisting the connector around and inverting the two wires. I'm not really sure about that, and it's not obvious to me from looking at the picture that that's the case.
Wesley has it in his hand. Why doesn't he try to see if he can reverse it?
Well, at first I sent the video to John, and John sent the video to Rich. So both of you gentlemen, you have the video, and apart from that, John could exactly accurately describe how the looks like. And
Wesley, we're talking about the little module, the cable that plugs into it with two pins. Can you put it in either way and run the ferrule down on it?
Oh yeah, I unscrewed the screws on it, and I made the pictures. I included pictures. Also, both of you gentlemen should have it in the email. Let me check if I have it. No, not in this email. Yes, no, but not unscrewed. It's in the video. Basically, there is nothing inside. It's extremely nicely done with two pieces of aluminium.
That's not what I asked you.
Go ahead, please.
Can you put that connector on the external module, the little box that you have? Can you put that connector on there either way and run the ferrule onto it?
Yes, I can.
Okay, so the polarity doesn't count.
Do it to CDO.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Lenkert 760 edited AVI right now. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, I think y'all just answered the question. I have twin axis connectors, both male, female, and all different types of adapters. So next week I'll tell you how the polarity is set up, because I can just look. And even though I'm not using them, I got a whole box full of them.
In my particular situation, there is no polarity. And John has seen also what is inside. There is nothing inside. Even though that on one of the drawings, I see the front page. I have the front page on the same email that you're looking with the schematic. I have a drawing of the front of the device, and next to it there is a test module schematic. It says test module schematic, and there is a test module. Although on this schematic there is a switch on it. If you could look at the schematic of that. When I unscrewed it, there was nothing. No resistor, no switch. It was just a connection straight to the pins. Maybe John would be able to describe better.
Okay, that two-pin PL259, we'll call it, plugs into this little extension box that he has, this little module. And there's just two wires running to the two phono probes that you see coming out in the photograph. Now, the input connector is the one he was talking about being high voltage. That's the longer extruded BNC connector that's used. It's a much sturdier piece, much stronger. It may have lower capacitance, I don't know, but it has a longer Teflon bulb, and it's good for up to 10,000 volts. I have that on several of my signal generators that put out like 3,000 volts and 5,000 volts. So that's why he thought this was a high voltage device. But the phone company never worked hardly above 48 volts, never above 100 that I know of.
Medium high voltage or something like that. And I believe that MHV connector, which has a longer piece of plastic and a longer semiconductor inside, both male and female. Ooh, I'm seeing the two pins right now, no polarity. That longer connector gives you a much longer path for the high voltage that it has to bridge in order to arc to ground. So do you believe it's an MHV connector that's on the BNC input side? John, go ahead.
WB2IKT. Dick, I found the white paper from Meldon and the full explanation. If you want, I can email it.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that, but give me a couple of words if they happen to give you an explanation. What do you think? I'll only find it by reading the actual paper.
Okay, it's kind of difficult to read some of these formulas over the air, but basically it's the characteristic impedance is defined as the propagation constant times attenuation constant of phase constant. So they have Greek letters. Alpha, capital alpha, I guess, is attenuation constant. Theta is a phase constant. And then the usual definitions, R, L, G for conductance, R and L for resistance. D is conductance, C is capacitance, F, and then omega as meaning 2 pi F. And then they go through a variety of formulas over here to go through this. But the cable impedance low and high definitely goes as a function of frequency, and it gets higher as you go into the audio frequency.
Okay, you've got a very good reference there, Belden. You got a very good book on the subject. I'm going to have to slowly believe it. The mechanism by which that happens is right now not known. That's Wesley's audio you hear in the background as this thing is playing. But I've now seen the picture of your device, Wes. And I can see how that twin lead connector, in your particular case, has no polarity. And if this was a piece of test equipment where they only cared about frequency response as opposed to exact phase of the signal itself, I can see how that happened. This sounds like it was a piece of test equipment. Is that what you view it as? I'm going to ask both John and George in that order. John first, go ahead.
Yes, Dick, that is definitely a test set. Back to you.
What do you believe they intended to test with it? A frequency response of the wiring of, for instance, an aircraft?
Yes, because they were sending these signals over common wires like the phone company uses in the street before they even went to aerial Twinax. They were trying to get video information and audio information down regular telephone lines, and that was a massive achievement. This device is doing exactly the testing where you could hook up the instrument and plug that phone port into your the rack at the wherever the terminator was, and you'd be able to look at either signal and analyze it on your piece of equipment. That's what I truly believe this is for. It's really a tuned balance, really.
So I think you said you would sweep the unknown system and really find its frequency response. Because of perturbations, length, resistance of the wire, whatever, water in the cable, and so on. So you would measure the frequency response of an unknown system using this piece of test equipment and a sweep generator, maybe, and some kind of display device that looked at power versus frequency. Over to you, John.
I think you have it exactly right. Also, something else that you mentioned, which came later, is the TwinAx may have gone from the CO to those transmitting towers you were talking about. And this device could have been used to go at the tower or at the CO to see if the signal, you know, comparing the inputs and outputs, that's a good call too. So that may have been used for that.
I'm having a problem with the portability of the device is okay, but then what kind of the measurement devices were connected to that? If we're talking about portability, it's 77.
And 77, an awful lot of things had tubes. So your IFR, your brand, that's the brand name of a service monitor for repeater sites in the late 60s, early 70s, was a pretty heavy piece of equipment with a carrying handle, probably weighed a healthy 50 pounds or more, with or without battery, and that was a piece of test equipment. It contained a signal generator and a power sensor and a rudimentary spectrum analyzer and a way of monitoring how strong was the PL tone, what was the frequency of the PL tone, what was the frequency of the signal that you're measuring, and so on. So it was a frequency standard, an amplitude standard. That's what a service monitor was for RF circuits. I am guessing that the TwinAx was used as the cable to run from the ground site somewhere, a CO maybe, up to the microwave tower. Then a modulator sent it over the microwave link. That may be the way the signals were really being conveyed. See if anybody agrees or disagrees with that. K2LIW.
Also, don't forget, Dick, the phone company was always measuring return loss signals, and this could play a very important part in that, too. But let's see what George has to say.
Yeah, John, I think you hit the nail on the head. The criteria was always balanced, because if those twin axes were balanced, and the telcos used DB systems to measure it, their goal for balancing a line was always better than 60 dB. That's a million to one, which is really hard to maintain, and I think they did a masterful job. Okay?
Yeah, run that by again. Are you telling me that the differential mode versus the common mode differed by 60 decibels? Wow. My goodness. And John is saying they really cared about reflection coefficient. And I guess one of the main reasons you would care about that is that it would create triple transit signals, which would be a ghosting on a video. So each one of your individual repeater sites would have to have very low standing wave ratio, so you didn't get triple transit, so you didn't get ghosting, because to go across a thousands of miles, you're going to go through a whole lot of microwave links that are 30 miles apart. 3,000 miles would be at 30 miles apiece, would be what, 100 of them. If each individual repeater site added its own personality to the signal, and you went through 100 of those, by the time it got to the other end, it would be pretty ratty looking. Over to you, George, K2RIW.
Dick, you're exact.
Clock not set. This is amateur radio repeater.
WHCDL.
RC25.286. Clock not set. Clock not set. Ready. Welcome to the W2. Clock not set.
Sounds like it's up, Dick.
Stand by. WHCDL. Stand by.
We're standing by, Eddie.
Dick, send me over your email address. I send you this felt paper. The ones I have for you don't seem to work.
Okay. The easiest one would be mycallletters@arrl.net. Go ahead.
All right. You should see this paper in a few minutes. Then.
Okay. Thank you. I've hit the bewitching hour. I better leave you guys. And we'll see you next week. This was TechNet number 1391 of the series that began in September of 1982. Be kind to each other. Bye-bye. I think the machine is going to stay up so you guys can keep right on talking. K2RIW.
73 seconds left. Here's the rule from Jimmy Stillwell. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
What was that again, Glenn?
That's somewhere about halfway through all this nonsense. I took a ride over to the over to the repeater site and kept them driving up and down the streets, and they must already know my vehicle, so whatever it was, at least they stopped jamming.
Okay, and you did that. Thank you. Bye-bye.
KC2QIQ.
Yeah, Glenn, thank you very much. Dick, thank you very much. I appreciate your time and your attention to the subject. Rich, so you think they were just preparing this device as a universal device with two ranges in the package for any case, whether it's going to be used for the military purposes on the ground or on the aircraft, because it looks like it definitely was made for the military. Am I right in that, Andrexia?
His name is George, not Rich.
Sorry. Stand by, I gotta make a change.
Getting old, Andrexia.
Stand by, guys, I gotta make a change. I know what it does, I have an idea of how it works. And to me, it's a fairly specialized device. If you have the need to match a 75-ohm coaxial line to a 20-axial line, that is a really good device to do it with. If you have the need to match 75 ohms to 125 ohms or so, for some other reason, it's probably useful. I don't believe the device handles a lot of power. So if you wanted to do it with a receiver, I would say go ahead. If you wanted to work that thing, say, as an antenna matching device with a QRP radio, you know, maybe up to 5 watts or so, I would say that thing is going to be pretty decent and probably work well. But I really wouldn't want to look at that thing with high power levels, you know, more than, you know, a few watts. And, you know, it's the oddball ham radio system that would end up with impedances of either 75 ohms or 125. So, you know, it's a specialized device for a specialized purpose. And, short of, you know, opening up the transformers and unwinding them or putting more windings on it, I don't know, I'm afraid it's a big heavy metal box that's not especially useful. What?
Wes, I wouldn't even touch the box. I'd leave that thing alone. You can build balance on the, to change it from 50 to 75 ohms on the input without even going in a box. And you can do the same thing with the balance output. No problem at all.
Guys, I'm going to play in here David's advocate. I claim I can put 5,000 watts on it, and it's not going to burn up. How do I do that? And to experience.
I guarantee you'll burn it up.
John, do you want to take bets on the barbecue?
Okay, guys, I'm telling you, there is a way to do it. A 2-watt tube, and I give you the model number of that tube, hold on, which was made mainly for the radar application, able to carry on 5,000 watts output in peak and to XM.
The only reason radar tubes put that out is because the duration of the pulse is very short. If you took a 10-watt tube and operated for 1/100th its duty cycle, then you could really get a lot of power out of the tube. What does that have to do with the device you have?
Well, the same story is with the device that I have. The shorter the impulse, the higher the power. Do you agree or totally disagree with you?
I agree to a point, but then you get into areas where the impulse is too strong. No matter what the duty cycle is, it'll break down. It's simple construction techniques.
George, the iMac 15R was capable of putting about 5,000 watts. The tube by itself was rated for 2 watts constant. Now, we have a circuitry in here that is made for maximum 2, maybe 5 watts. That's maximum that it could carry on. I mean, the resistors are pretty good, and the transformer looks like possibly in the low frequency range could really carry on like, well, say 5 watts. Say 5 watts. Question is, would I be able to put the 1,000 watts on it in impulse and it will still not burn up? Back to you, George.
Well, if you want to play that, get your hot dogs out. Seriously, Wes. You know, that's like John was trying to say. I ran a system. It's not designed to take more than that. In fact, a large part of these systems was designed to save power by allowing some peak voltages to occur, but anything that was sustained would result in overheating effects. So you can't take it. The telco certainly didn't use that kind of power. You know, they would be transmitting these things at, you know, plus 10 dBm, plus 20 dBm, and anything with more transmission power than maybe plus 26 dBm would be extremely unusual in a telco facility. So I would be really much surprised if it could handle any more power than that. And Try putting more in, but the smell of smoke is something you probably enjoy. John?
Yeah, I...